Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight is Tuesday, June 30th, 2020, the last Tuesday in June. And tonight we are saying, without solidarity in the people's movement, the struggle is lost. And many people are saying, what struggle? The 4th of July never was real, and it never had anything to do with them in the first place. So, please be aware that we are talking about an anatomy of oppression, which requires an anatomy of colonialism and imperialism. And if you're talking about that, then you are talking about American capitalism. And there is no way you can defeat this empire without unity. And tonight we have a number of special guests who are extremely concerned about the current events and the state of human rights all over the world. And don't forget, human rights involves the right to freedom, housing, medical care, education without metaphysical imperialism, and above all, the right to dream of a future. So without further ado, Ralph Pointer, what's happening?
Good evening, my brothers and sisters. And I think my credo fits as time goes on. And it's what I believe. The overriding element in every situation or circumstance in a black life is racism. birth, elementary school, housing, health, food, etc. Black lives have never mattered except during slavery and other circumstances where money is being made by our laborers for others. The modern death penalty, 80% black, moved lynching indoors. The police, as the army of occupation, have taken lynching outside again. The lynch mob is the racist system, including the courts and the media. And because the lives of our heroes and sheroes, who once protected us and our community, do not matter to us, the people, our political prisoners are now dying in captivity. They are tortured and isolated. Only armed struggle can recreate our image in our own minds as well as the minds of others. Wake up, now is the time. April 2015, and every day that credo becomes more real. Now, Miss Davis, Sister Betty, will you read what the title of this evening's discussion is?
Once again, as we said, without solidarity in the people's movement, the struggle is lost. But before we start that, Brother Ralph, we need to adhere to our format, which is that we always honor Sister Lynn by starting off with poetry. So without further ado, we want to open the mic of a very, very special young lady, Sarah Adams from Rochester, who is a student, all right? This is a student in the public school system, the product of some very progressive parents and advocates for community control of education. This is Sarah, your mic is open.
Hey, everybody. So today I'm going to be doing a poem. This is probably like the first poem that I wrote with the teacher who made the poem that I read last week. So this is the first poem that I wrote what got me interested in poetry. What in the world do I have to claim for you to understand that we're all the same? We're not the only ones you have to blame. And the way that you treat us, it's really a shame. All I want you to know is that people are people, and that walking down the street, it's not illegal. But killing colored people, you make that seem legal. Why can't you disagree that we're all equal? Did you notice you got people out here wishing to live? Because y'all kill people simply for the color of their skin. Activity, it's got to come to an end. I want to see some world peace. When will it begin? Breaking news, a black man just got shot. And apparently it has something to do with a cop. That's the same thing I hear all the time, nonstop. I want to see something positive. Chill with the gunshots. I don't even know how to put it into words. It's like the world got itself stuck up under a curse. Kids are dying. There's police violence. About it, they lying. And it's terrifying. Hands up, don't shoot. It's more than just a saying. It's a message representing the events that keep replaying. Innocent black people getting shot by all these racists. And the change that's soon to come is something that keeps on delaying. Because honestly, the person being killed is all that's changing. Watching colored people die, is it something entertaining? Police brutality is something still remaining in the power. It's something they're continuously gaining. But we will change that. Thank you.
Well, we are the ones who thank you. And once again, we want to remind people that this theme is about without solidarity in the people's movement, the struggle is lost. And this family is and has always been about solidarity. You cannot mention a struggle in the last 10 to 15 years that they have not supported in one way or another. They really exemplify what we mean by this theme. Without solidarity in the people's movement, the struggle is lost. So before we go down our list of contributors, which is quite long this evening. Brother Ralph, the mic is yours.
Thank you so much for that, Sister Betty. And when we talk about the struggle from relief from the cruelties of corporate capitalism, and I have always said capitalism merely means organized robbery. But even before the term capitalism was coined, we have to realize it's been a struggle for the wealthy, for the powerful, against the poor and the weak. We didn't start the class struggle because yesterday, royalty are today's wealthy, and they have always operated under one premise: to gain wealth at the expense of the poor. European serfs, peasants, etc., were used by kings, queens, dukes, counts, and etc. to achieve wealth and a certain way of life. Slavery in the New World. They have always had the ability to organize the poor to fight to enrich themselves. Witness World War I. Kings and queens and cousins having the world fight on their behalf. And to counteract that, the poor, that's you and me, my brothers and sisters, must work on one premise. That is a social contract of universal wealth. Without the cohesion of that single premise, the left or the people will always fall short of defeating those with the single premise of accumulation. And as Reverend Pinckney has said over and over again, it's not about one thing, it's about everything. And we must support rules, regulations, and governments to achieve this support of clearing up everything for the benefit of the people, everyone. And I don't want to get in any deeper because we have guests who are going to get into health care and what is happening with the people. Sister Betty, I turn it back to you.
All right. I want to recognize that all of our guests have tuned in, and we recognize we want to give you a COVID update. But since we're talking about the concept of solidarity, we have one of our longtime comrades who's with us this evening, who exemplified only too well through his organizational skills in the Black and Brown protest march, which honored the, I call it, the nation of Puerto Rico, also honored the struggle in this country and the solidarity. Brother Mark Torres of the People Pueblo Party, your mic is open. As you know, our theme is, without solidarity in the people's movement, the struggle is lost.
Hey, thank you, Sister Betty and Brother Ralph. Glad to be on the show again. You know, I feel like when I'm here, I'm with family. So this is wonderful, and thank you for this opportunity. Is there is anything in particular you wanted me to talk about? Did you want me to talk about the particulars of the march, or?
Yes, I think
yeah.
you should give them an
okay.
update how successful the march was and why it was successful and how it ties into this charge to all of us that without solidarity, the people's movement and the people's movement, the struggle is lost. I think the parade definitely exemplified that.
Right. Well, the march and rally was very important. And as you know, I think Mickey Melendez, a former Young Lords Party member, and Professor Johanna Fernandez from Baruch College, I think, engaged in a conversation. They said, hey, you know, we should do something around solidarity between Black and Brown people. And then they called different people, and then, you know, I was one of the people they called, and then, like myself, other people also gathered other people that we work with and invited them to come and participate in the organizing of it. And it was really great because it was timely, because at that point, the mainstream media and the power structure were trying to create a wedge between black and brown people in New York City, and, you know, over some incidents that happened in Dyckman. And so, you know, for one, our group felt like, hey, we have to do this. We have to get this event on board, and we have to handle this, because in New York City anyway, black and brown people make up the majority and really make up the nucleus or the base of any revolutionary movement that's going to develop. You know, and we have historical facts and historical events to back that up. And you know, today more and more, there's another white flight happening, you know, between COVID, between, you know, the fight against the police brutality, the incessant firecrackers and explosions every night, and the fact that a lot of these white folks who are gentrifiers can work online now means that they have to leave the city, or can leave the city and go back to the suburbs, you know, from whence they came. And what's happening is that, you know, we see this coming. And so, you know, in the 70s, there was white flight, and it really depressed the inner cities. Services were cut, poverty rose. So, you know, it's kind of like, well, what's going to prevent that from happening again? And what's going to prevent that from happening again is solidarity between black and brown people in New York City and other major cities. Because depending how long this COVID thing lasts and depending how the economy goes, the federal government might just give up on urban areas and cities altogether. I remember, I'm old enough to remember when Ford told New York City to drop dead. Right? Y'all remember that, right? So it might be the same thing again. Right now, there's a bill through Congress to make whole state and local governments, and that bill right now is stalled. So what we need to do is we need to build infrastructure. We need to build up our communities. We need to look at the economics and politics of our communities. And this march was a good step in that direction. Now, the march was great. We had thousands of people out. We started up in Quisqueya Heights, 168th Street, at near the Audubon Ballroom, where Don Pedro Albizu Campos and Malcolm X spoke regularly. And then we went down West Harlem through Central Harlem and over down to East Harlem, and really connecting those roots. And, you know, the energy was great. You know, it was put together, you know, kind of last minute with not a lot of time to organize. And a lot of groups came together, you know, and it was very successful for what the goal was, which was to have clear, visible, and energized solidarity between black and brown communities, including, you know, Dominicans, Puerto Ricans, Mexicans, with the African-American community. And it was very successful on that point. So it was a step in the right direction. I think also, some of the folks who helped to organize that event on that day are, I think they're still meeting. I think they call themselves, I'm not too sure, the June 14th Brigade. And it looks like they're focusing a lot of attention on culture. But I don't know what else they might be doing. But I think one of the things that that Solidarity March and rally showed is that we need a united front that can organize on a more sustained level. I think that, you know, because we don't have an international action center that's vibrant the way it used to be, we don't have citywide coalitions that exist anymore the way they have in the past. I think that the way to go is to build a united front of different organizations and individuals. They want to do some more long-term planning. They want to do economic planning. They want to do political planning. You know, a lot of what the Solidarity March was about identity. And, you know, if we are serious about being revolutionaries and needing a revolution in this country, then we really have to delve more deeply and do more planning to address economic and political issues, in first in our city and then in the country.
Well, thank you so much, Brother Mark. Brother Ralph, did you want to contribute to that before we move on? Brother Ralph. Okay. We may have had a disconnect. Brother Ralph is calling from quite a distance. I just want to say once again, Brother Mark, thank you so much.
Absolutely.
All right. We're
Let
going
me
to move
try
on.
Again. Can you hear me?
Yes,
now
we
can
hear
you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, we can hear
I
you.
I said our next guest is Dr. Zenobia Brown, who will give us the reality of the black and brown people as related to coronavirus. Very important that we understand that reality. Sister Dr. Zenobia Brown.
Hey, good evening, listeners, and thank you for having me on the program. And thanks for allowing me some time to talk about this important sort of problem that we're having in the black and brown communities as it relates to COVID-19. So a lot is in the media right now. So the purpose today is really to talk about COVID-19 in the setting of hundreds of years of institutional racism and why this virus is now and any future pandemic will cut a swath across the black and brown communities. So as we sort of start to think about sort of what is the history of healthcare for black and brown people, if you can call it that, you only have to go so far as the Tuskegee experiment. You only have to go so far as the Henrietta Lacks. So definitely read that book if you've not read that book. You have to talk about Dr. Marion Sims, who, you know, very complicated history with Dr. Sims, who is an OB-GYN doctor who performed surgery on slaves and the lack of science at that time and what that does to the psyche of black and brown people to basically be used as experiments for hundreds of years to further science. But you don't have to go that far back because if you even just look at the 2020 National Healthcare Quality and Disparities Report. So this is a report that is sanctioned and mandated by Congress since 2000. So for the past 20 years, we've been measuring the disparities in healthcare, and that's an important point. So when we talk about healthcare equity, that is the ability for any human to have the same opportunity for health as any other human. And when we talk about disparities, what we're talking about is the differences in the healthcare outcomes of the different people. So you can imagine if you don't have healthcare equity, if you don't have the ability to have the same healthcare as the person standing next to you, there are going to be healthcare disparities. And what they found in the most recent survey, right, survey across America, was that almost 70% of these measures, which were things like safety, healthy living, effective treatments, all of these measures were improving. However, when you broke it down by blacks, American Indians, Alaska Natives, Native Hawaiians, and Pacific Islanders, they were worse than whites in 40% of those measures. Hispanics received worse care than whites for about 35% of those measures. And that disparities were improving. So disparities, the healthcare outcomes, we're improving for only 5 measures for Hispanic out of 250, improving only 5 for Hispanics and 4 for blacks and 2 for Alaska Natives and American Indians. So what does that tell you? In the baseline, America at baseline, while 70% of measures are improving overall, if you look at black and brown and Native persons, First Nations people, they are improving minutely, if at all. So that is how we step into coronavirus, is with a systemic disparities between black and brown people and white people. And for that reason, what we are now seeing is that coronavirus has caught a lethal swath across those communities of color. And just to kind of give some updates in terms of just some basic statistics around the coronavirus. So if you look, so I think your listenership is going to know that there's some disproportion, but the numbers are so staggering, I just wanted to share a few right now. So African Americans are accounting for about 47% of Philadelphia's cases, even though they represent only about 25% of the population. In York, Pennsylvania, Latinx people are accounting for about 72% of cases, and they only make up 33% of the population. In the city, right, so we're coming down on those cases again, black and brown people make up about 30% of the population, but have accounted for more than 60% of all of the deaths in coronavirus. If we can go anywhere in the country, so if we go to St. Louis, 12 people in 19 are black who died from coronavirus and currently represent about 70-80% of all the coronavirus cases in St. Louis. Chicago is the same story, representing about 75% of diagnoses and about 40 to 30% of the population. Now, very important case, because what typically happens, what always happens to black and brown people whenever there is a healthcare disparity? Where do we go with that? Right away, the media, everyone else wants to talk about there's a genetic difference. So genetic differences in black and brown people have been accounting for why black people can't be a quarterback or why they can't be doctors. So when you, I just want your listenership to really, when you're listening to these media reports, listen for these undercurrents of racism that have to do with a genetic predisposition or a lifestyle or a habit that a person might have that makes them more likely to have it, instead of really addressing some of the societal, structural, racist patterns in healthcare that are contributing. And I'm just, I know you've got a lot of guests, so I'm going to try to wrap it up, but talk just very briefly about some of those things. So I did want to just jump right into work, because this is a narrative you are not hearing, right? So one of the things, so what do we know about how do you prevent coronavirus? It is about social distancing. It is about staying at home. So when you think about who can stay at home, the ability to work from home, to get a paycheck, that is a privilege. And what we understand is that because of the structural racism in this country, black and brown people are less likely to have those kinds of jobs where they can collect a paycheck from home. However, it is also important to understand this is not a narrative that you typically hear about, oh, those black and brown people are in the ghettos and they're overcrowding. This is a narrative of black and brown people who, during this epidemic, have done all, as typical, have done all of the work that keeps the country going. So despite the fact that black and brown people make up about 12% of all employed workers, they account for about 30% of the licensed practical and licensed vocational nurses in this country. They make up 26% of the public transit workers, 19% of child care workers, and 20%, 18 to 20% of warehouse, trucking, and postal. So what does that tell you? So if you are in a job that is keeping the country going, you are at a higher risk for contracting COVID-19. So we need to remember that narrative, as the media narrative is this perpetuating myth of black and brown people do not work. Black and brown people are working, and it is leading to increasing cases. Similarly, across the healthcare industry. Also, this issue of there are inequities in the work around paid sick leave, all of these things which are likely, again, to have black and brown people working out in, we're going to call it the front line of society, exposing themselves to COVID-19. And again, I'm going to kind of try to keep it short. You know, we also understand access to care. This goes all the way back to redlining, right? So this idea of neighborhoods being destroyed and never rebuilt goes into healthcare. So if you look at a heat map across these cities, Where are the primary care offices? Where are the hospitals? Where are the subspecialists, right? The ENT, the pulmonologist, they are not in the black and brown communities. So now you step back and say, so why are people getting so sick and then getting to the hospital and dying? If their access, right, their healthcare equity, their ability to access healthcare is lower, they are going to have a disequity. They're going to have an outcome in healthcare that is worse than their white counterparts. Underlying health conditions. So what we understand is that there are serious underlying medical conditions are an increased risk for death in coronavirus, and that this has a lot to do with or some contributing factor around why black and brown people are dying at a higher rate of coronavirus. But what is not mentioned is the relationship of that to police brutality. So I just also want your listenership to know that it is already documented, this is not new information, that police brutality as a single risk factor increases the likelihood for hypertensive disease and then all of the things that come with that, heart disease, stroke, et cetera, et cetera. So police brutality and an exposure to a hostile police encounter already increases your risk of death. So then when you understand that and then go into a pandemic where people who have a chronic condition are more likely to die, it all really comes together. So what are the other kind of pieces of that that I would just, the one other thing I have to mention before we get off the phone as it relates to COVID-19, black and brown people, this concept of the industrial prison complex and putting our brothers and sisters in prisons at disproportionate rates to white men. And this now, we again, it is the perfect storm of we have used the prisons to jail, to put them in the death camps, and now coronavirus is in those prisons, and those prisoners are dying at high rates. So I think people, I will just talk very briefly about some of the experiences in California. So right now you have basically just very recently 121 prisoners came from Chino where there were 700 cases and 9 deaths, and they were basically bused to San Quentin. Now why would you do that? Why would you take prisoners from one jail where you knew you had an outbreak and then send them to San Quentin that had 3,700 inmates and at that point had no cases, 1,000 cases of COVID, okay, in San Quentin? And when thus far on the investigation, there was no testing, they maybe took their temperature, but then again, there was no isolation of those folks who came from a facility where they knew there were infections. So again, it really does underscore when you have a, so everything is related. Your police brutality, you're creating illness, it's a public health emergency. You are jailing people. You're putting them in these prisons. There is no way to socially distance. And then you are transporting prisoners from one prison to the next, infecting huge thousands of people with no real plan, no real kind of vision as to how to quell this. I'm going to stop my comments there, but I did want to thank you for the opportunity to kind of talk about what are some very broad issues in public health and what is affecting our black and brown brothers and sisters, and really what is a public health emergency in terms of COVID-19 and how the structural racism of this country is now contributing to this problem.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, my dear sister, Dr. Zenobia Brown. And as we say, what's happening? You want to know what's happening? Tune in. We are archived, and we hope that those around the country who have been loyal listeners, spread the word. What's happening? Tune in. Sister Betty Davis, the mic is yours.
All right. 2 points. First of all, before we go to Chicago for an update on and an overview of what's going on there with Brother Joseph Peary, I want to point out that we tried to start this program on an up note of the solution to the problem. I can't stand when people just talk about the problem and not come up with some of the solutions. And one of the solutions is in our theme, that without solidarity in the people's struggle, the struggle in the people's movement, the struggle will be lost. Sister Dr. Zenobia Brown touched on housing, on health, on terrorism, which is what the Army of Occupation is there for, on the workers. And what Brother Torres tried to explain to us is that a parade is not just a place where we march and sing. It was a parade of protest and unity. Just about every union you can imagine participated in that parade. And that's one of the solutions to the problem. Because Sister Dr. Brown mentioned who are the workers on the front lines we are. And with mine, I want to open up the mic for Brother Joseph Peary, if that's all right, Brother Ralph, from Chicago.
Yes, Sister Betty, it's Zena, it's Dr. Brown again. There was one thing, and I really want to appreciate what you said about you've got to have some uplifting kind of something, and I didn't mean to kind of bring everybody down. One of the, and just, again, but I do have to keep it rooted in science, one of the things that is very important for the listenership to hear is that the protests, so if you, and I've been at the protests, I'm sure, that, you know, everyone, and it's so important. What we understand is that those protests, so we've been protesting now in New York City for the past 4 or 5 weeks, and we are not seeing the increase in cases. So we've got hundreds of thousands of people protesting many times a day, and you've been at these protests. We're not seeing the increased cases. What that is telling us is that with everybody wearing masks, with people using common sense, you can still fight the fight and stay healthy. It is doing all, and what I love to see out there in the protest is everybody's wearing a mask. You have tents where they're giving out masks for people who don't have them. You've got free hand sanitizer going. You've got everybody out there fighting the fight but staying healthy, and that is really good news because it means we can do both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for that, Sister Dr. Zenobia Brown. And now, back to Sister Betty Davis.
Yeah, that's what Brother Mark's people did. They gave out water. They gave out masks. Nobody went without that did not have. Plus, they had leading the protest parade was the van of nurses from the nurses union. So, again, we can fight back, and we must. But we got to do it with intelligence. And it is stupid if you know your enemy, your friend, is fighting the same enemy that you're fighting, that you should not unite with them to do it. And that's what this broadcast is about. So in unity, Brother Peary, your mic is open. I know you usually have other meetings to attend. That's why we're taking you. Go ahead, Brother Peary.
Oh, well, thank you. Actually, yes, thank you. Thanks for having me, Sister Betty and Brother Ralph. Actually, I just got out of a meeting a little while ago, so it's pretty good timing. Anyway, yeah, I wanted to make a few comments, if I can, about, about unity and about the solidarity. I want to just say this first. I'm old enough to remember the 60s. And, you know, I've never in my life seen this much unity out here as I've seen in the past, 5 weeks, 6 weeks. I mean, people are marching all over the place, just like the sister said, Ms. Brown, she just said a second ago, and yet we don't have a spike in the cases like you would expect, and it's because people are doing the things that she had mentioned. And that's in spite of this orange-haired monkey we got for president. But anyway... And I'm going to have to just maybe kind of put a little pin in that one, because actually we talk about Trump because he's the front man, but we don't pay attention a lot of times to what's behind Trump. And it's he's got about 30 of these corporations and some leadership council of his, and it's their agenda. I mean, I'm sure he's got his own personal thing in there, but it's basically their agenda. And so, instead of us talking about Trump, you know, just as Trump. We have to talk about it as Trump and his corporate backers, or if you want to, these American corporations and their front man, Trump. And if you look from the very beginning, you know, their whole idea, I think they knew that we were due for some economic hard times, and therefore it was going to be an upsurge in the spontaneous movement out there. And so, you know, they come up with Trump and this MAGA, Make America Great Again, right? And I think a lot of the people who are protesting have correctly translated that as to what it really is, Make America Hate Again. And so I think we should ask ourselves, what's the origin of all this? How far back does it go? And the earliest thing I could find was 1640. There was a case in the Chesapeake area of Virginia where a guy was, you know, he owned a tobacco farm, and he had three indentured servants working for him. And one of them was a guy named Victor from Holland. The other one was a guy from Scotland named James Gregory. And then the other one was an African named John Punch. And so these guys were treated so badly together that they all just decided we're going to get up and run. So they got up and they ran. And they were gone maybe 3-4 days, and they were picked up and brought back. And they were brought directly in front of a magistrate. And the magistrate called first the two. And let me mention, when they entered into that courtroom, they were all chained together. And they were united by bonds of class as slaves together. And the judge called, or the magistrate called, for the two white guys to come up. And he sentenced them 4 more years added on to their indentured servitude and 30 lashes apiece. I guess they called it stripes in those days. And sent him out of the courtroom. And then he called the black man up, John Punch. And he said to John Punch, he said to the court, he said, and this sentence is infinitely worse than the sentence he just gave the other fellas. He made it so that John Punch would be an indentured servant for the rest of his natural life. Now, that's the first thing I found where this took place. And you gotta think about, why would they do that? There's no law on the books making this kind of a differentiation. There's no law on the books to say that give the judge the ability to do this, however he did it. And I think you can kind of guess about it and understand that you had just had a bunch of slave rebellions taking place, and they felt like, you know, this thing get out of hand, you know, the way to put an end to it is we're going to have to pit one against the other, give privileges to the one and not give privileges to the other, this sort of thing. But it went much worse than that, because during that entire year, this was July 9th, 1640, when this happened, for the following year, all the colonies began to change their laws, and they made slavery a racial thing. It all began to take a racial tint, right? And so if you look at what the let me put it this way, if I can be poetic about it, those three gentlemen entered that courtroom united by bonds of class in solidarity. In escaping from slavery, the bonds of class of slavery, and they literally left that courtroom with those bonds broken and blown. And it's been like that ever since. You know, and if you look at the American Revolution, they had a chance where they could have changed, they could have done something about it. All they really did as a result of the American Revolution is that the northern colonies, one by one, over a period of years, got rid of slavery. We could have gotten rid of this nonsense in the Civil War, and we tried it again in the Civil Rights Movement. And yet we're still haunted by this legacy of slavery, which is racism, which is the number one reason why we can't keep the solidarity together, the number one reason why we haven't been able to keep the solidarity together in our movements to start with. And so, you know, I think as Americans, we've sort of been taught to look upon class and race is these two, you know, where you really think about race all the time, but you're not much thinking about the class aspects of it, right? And, you know, because if you do that, it's pretty much impossible to get equals, unequals to unite. So I think what's occurring now which everybody has sort of spoke to, so I don't want to really go back into that. But it's like, you know, we've been in a recession since February. You got COVID-19 is really exposing more about the economics. You got high unemployment. You got mass death going on. And then and then of course, there's the infiltration into the police departments and the military of these white supremacist groups. And, of course, that their whole agenda is about going out and targeting the blacks to kill the blacks. And basically get away with it. It's terrorism. And so we've got homelessness on the increase. We've got a situation where people are going to probably end up getting thrown on the street in the middle of a pandemic, for crying out loud. I mean, my God, unbelievable. And if you look at it, though, I would say prior to now that probably the place I saw the most amount of unity among poor people was really among the homeless, because the homeless are very accepting. I think there's sort of an equality of being, you know, in the same boat with each other, just as those three slaves were in the same boat with each other. There's sort of an equality of that, that exists among the homeless. But I think what I didn't take into account is the fact that you got everybody walking around with basically a supercomputer in their hand with a camera. I mean, half the human race has got cell phones. And literally anybody, like this 17-year-old girl who videotaped George Floyd, was able to, I mean, you literally are a broadcasting station. You can send this on social media. It goes all over. The whole world saw it. And I was shocked when I began to see, like I live in Cabrini Green. But as a gesture, the protesters marched over behind my house, and there's an area where they tore down public housing, and they purposely made a gesture. 30,000 people showed up, and they set up a makeshift stage, and they started giving speeches, and they went all into the history of the United States. I mean, they went into a lot of the stuff I'm telling you now about slavery and this sort of thing, and that they want to root this out. They're going to go after white supremacy, and they understand white supremacy is exactly what's going on. And so I think that we got a real chance right now to end white supremacy. I think the key is to keep the pressure going out there in the street and to do more exposure. There's a lot more exposure. And I think there's a lot more exposure needs to happen. I write for the newspaper, the People's Tribune, and, you know, there's a lot of investigative reporters with more skill than myself and more at their disposal in terms of, means that they can go out here and they can find out these connections between these corporations, these politicians, and these white supremacist groups, and show all these interconnections of how they're working together. Literally, they got a conspiracy against the American people doing what they're doing. So I'm saying that we need to have more exposure. We need to keep that pressure up in the street. Keep up that. Let me give you an example, too, of just some things I saw. I saw with my own eyes, right, out here. Cops getting ready to jump on Black Lives Matter protesters, and literally white people stand up and jump in the way and say, you're going to have to go through us first. And the cops looking at them like they don't know what to do. They're just absolutely confused. And to be honest with you, I think Trump was actually going to try something when he went to do that photo shoot of his in D.C. that time, where he actually beat up everybody on the street, and he was trying to get the military came out and made a statement, no, we're not going to do that. But I guarantee there would have been all black protesters out there. There would have been some worse violence. It would have been awful. I don't think they would hold back. And I think this has kind of taken that white supremacist movement, by surprise. And so you put all this together, and what I'm saying and what I'm thinking what we need to do is keep this pressure going. And if we can do that, we can take this ghost that orange-haired, Agent Orange, orange-haired monkey we got for president has resurrected. Him and his corporate friends have resurrected this white supremacy. Then we can go on and take that ghost and we can bury it forever. So I'll end my comments there. Let me say something. If people wanted to contact myself at the People's Tribune, let me give some info. The phone number is 800-691-6888. Again, I'm Joseph Peary. That's 800-691-6888. The P.O. Box here in Chicago is 3524 Chicago, Illinois, 60654. And you can also email us at info@peoplestribune.org. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for that, Joseph Peary. Sister Betty, give me a moment. If you want to know what's happening, tune in to Ralph Pointer, what's happening every Tuesday. The program is archived, and we will continue with bringing education, 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 free our political prisoners to the whole population. Sister Betty, the mic is yours.
No, the mic is Jericho from New York City. Sister Ann, we heard the report from Dr. Brown about the deliberate death machines in the death camps. I know you can add to that. And we had some terrible news. One of our warriors was up for compassionate release, which we fought so hard for Sister Lynn successfully, and yet this warrior was not released. Ann Lam, your mic is open.
Oh, thank you so much, Sister Betty. Brother Ralph, always an honor to be with you folk. Marius Mason was denied compassionate release, and the judge made this, like, sort of rather flippant remark. Well, nobody's actually died from COVID yet at Danbury. Well, you're going to wait until people die before you give them compassionate release? That would be a little ridiculous, right? So that was Marius, who is already suffering from COVID-19 and who is older and who has served most of his sentence and who, you know, meets all the criteria. So, the usual disgusting BS from the state, you know, when it comes to the COVID. So that was bad news. And I don't know if they're going to try round two. I'm trying to find that out. And, you know, we did get a pretty detailed thing about COVID, and we know how much it disproportionately affects black and brown people. Or the majority of people in our prisons, okay? You know, we know damn well that the majority of people in our prisons are black and brown people who shouldn't be there, okay? So as of today, according to the UCLA law, COVID-19 Behind Bars Data Project, I'm constantly promoting them because they do such great work. We have confirmed cases throughout the country, including prisons, jails, and federal prisons, confirmed cases of residents, 53,389 people are sick in prisons with this disease, okay? 616 people have been given the death sentence because of this disease, and none of them were sentenced to death. And of the 616 people, 16 of them have died in prisons in the state of New York, and those are just the state prisons. So, you know, this is really outrageous, and as we know, San Quentin has now got more than 1,000 cases, which, you know, was already spoken to because they were moving people around who were positive and they didn't test them. And now San Quentin, which had no cases in the past 2 weeks, has gone from zero to more than 1,000. So, you know, it's the kind of nonsense that goes on when people, you know, we're like locked out. We can't even go to visit. You know, it's very hard to get people on the phone. You know, so it's really hard to get information. So while people are not looking, this is what they do. And I agree with your whole concept of today's, you know, show about solidarity. I was at the demo that Mark was talking about. It was really good. We need to do more. Now the Palestinians are having, starting tomorrow, a day of rage, days of rage worldwide due to this, you know, plan to annex their entire country by the Zionist entity. So that is something we should, of course, all be in solidarity with in addition to everything we're doing here. Now, I know of two things that are happening on Saturday, July 4th, or July 4th, as we like to call it. One is right here in the Bronx, and this is sort of a little continuation of the black and brown unity thing, because this is also being called by veteran Black Panthers and Young Lords. So apparently there has been, it's horrible to say, nooses found in Van Cortlandt Park. So on Saturday, July 4th, people will be meeting. This says an urgent call from Northwest Bronx Resistance for veteran Black Panthers and Young Lords who worked in their respective Bronx and Mount Vernon, New York branch offices to come and speak on Saturday, July 4th to the current racial attacks on the Black and Brown Bronx community of Mashulu Parkway, Norwood, and Dan Cortlandt Park. Okay? So this is a neighborhood where I used to live, and this is really, you know, horrifying to see. And this is in response to nooses found in Van Cortlandt Park. So people are going to be meeting July 4th, that's Saturday, at 11 a.m., West Mashulu Parkway North. They didn't put it here, but it is West Mashulu Parkway North and Gates Place, which is about two blocks west of the train station, you know, the Jerome Avenue 4 train. And this is marking and celebrating why they're at this location. It's the historical location of the Black Panthers and Young Lords' former office in the Bronx. All right? So if people want any more information, they can get in touch with our friend, Brother Shep, Panther Shep Cat, all one word, at AOL.com. But that should be something happening right here, very important, once again. You know, Black and Brown unity against these white supremacists, because who else is going to be putting nooses in Van Cortlandt Park? And then also on the same day at noon in Philadelphia, as I call it, Philadelphia, there is a whole protest against police terror, which is including, of course, Mumia, because this weekend is the anniversary of his sentencing. So this is going to be a combo demo with Black Lives Matter and Brown Lives Matter and Mumia folk. And that's in Philly on July 4th at noon. And that is, as they say, where the Rizzo statue used to be, the Municipal Service Building, 1401 JFK Boulevard in Philadelphia, which is very close to City Hall. It's about a block away. So there's the two things going on. If you can't get to Philly, you can certainly come to the Bronx. Very urgent. And we do need people's solidarity. We need solidarity with people inside. We need solidarity with people outside. We need solidarity with all people. We need white people especially to stand up and be in solidarity with Black and Brown people, and I have seen a lot of that. I am very happy to say, as the brother from Chicago was saying, you know, it's really great to see so many different people all coming together for an issue, and we do have to make it more than a moment. It has to become a movement. We have to change the system. We have to do it. You know, if we don't do it, we are just, you know, I mean, I can't imagine that. I know we can do it. But, you know, we have to do it intelligently. We have to do it in an organized fashion. We have to have plans. You know, we have to, as Mark was saying, we need more, even just in New York, more citywide, you know, united front. Because the only way we're going to defeat this fascist state is having a united front. Because they love to divide us. They love that shit. You know, let's divide and conquer. Divide et impera, said Julius Caesar, and they've been doing it ever since. So, so the prisoners are, you know, imprisoned, and we are trying to get them out of there, not just our own brothers and sisters, you know, but everybody. Yeah.
I just want to interrupt for a second to say we have extended the program because we do have quite a list of special guest speakers. I just wanted you to know that the program has extended. There's time for everybody. Hey, Ann, you
okay,
can wind it up.
Yeah, it was winding up. That was just to say, you know, if you can come out to the Bronx, I'm sure there's other demonstrations happening all throughout. You know, there are things going on every day. But this thing on Saturday at 11 sounds very important. If there's some folk hanging nooses in Van Cortlandt Park, you know, that is mostly people of color community, and we don't need this stuff going on. So that is the same. Some of the same people who organized the June 14th march that Mark was talking about, the veteran Black Panthers and the Young Lords. So it should be an interesting event. And also, of course, the one in Philly, you know, as we could do every year, we come out at least, you know, we come out more than twice a year for Mumia, but we always do the anniversary of his sentencing, and we always do the anniversary of the day of his capture. So, you know, those are 2 days that were always have been dedicated to Mumia ever since he was captured way back on December 9th, 1981. And I can remember standing out in Philly with Safia Bukhari when she was reading Frederick Douglass's 4th of July. So, you know, we need to be there for him and for everybody because, you know, if we don't free ourselves, who's going to do it? So that's
Thank
the call
you,
that I have. What's the call? Free us all.
Well, Brother Ralph,
Yes.
Before we move.
Yes. I'm losing you.
Did you want to comment before we move on?
No, please move on. It's wonderful. And as I say for our programs, I love listening more than I do talking. And it's about education, 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 and I'm learning. Continue the struggle through information, Sister Betty.
Brother Tom, your mic is open.
Once again, the two-party duopoly shows its true face. On the one hand, the Republicans and the Trump regime, with the support of the Democrats, passed the CARES Act that allocated $12 trillion to the big banks and corporations. A measly $1,200 check was sent to the poor and working class, although millions were not eligible to receive it. And the Senate will probably not approve another check. Those millions who lost their jobs will have to apply for unemployment compensation and survive on that. Now, both Mayor de Blasio and Governor Cuomo say that the city and state are running out of money because caused by a substantial decrease in revenues due to the coronavirus and the lockdown of the economy. They blame the Trump regime for not providing enough financial help. So what do? They propose austerity budgets that will cut social services, affecting primarily the poor and working class New Yorkers, and lay off thousands of city and state workers, many of whom are people of color. The governor plans to cut $400 million from New York State's $35 billion Medicare program. He also says he might lay off state workers, and Mayor de Blasio threatens to cut social services and lay off 22,000 city workers, affecting workers in city hospitals, public schools, public parks, libraries, etc. However, they do not plan to end huge subsidies and tax exemptions for the ultra-rich. Here are examples of how they could avoid cutting social services and avoid laying off state and city workers. End the $1 billion annual tax exemption, 421A, for big real estate developers. Stop refunding the stock transfer tax to investors. This is a very small tax, up to 5 cents on each purchase and sale of stock, which would result in over $16 billion annually for New York. Charge a special tax on the purchase and sale of million-dollar-plus condos and co-ops. Increase state and city income taxes and end tax loopholes for the rich. Raise the top New York income tax rate for multimillionaires. Right now, the top income tax is only 8.5%, and many billionaires take advantage of loopholes and pay little, if any, state tax. The federal government already gives huge tax breaks for the wealthy. And these aforementioned tax reforms will not only avoid laying off city and state workers and cutting social services, but would generate enough revenues to increase funding public hospitals, schools, parks, and end warehousing the homeless. But this will not be done, because in capitalism, profits go before people. Not only is capitalism incapable of solving the budget crisis, but it is also incapable of solving the COVID-19 crisis and also the climate crisis. Until the majority of the people realize this, including those in the Black Lives Matter movement, these crises will continue. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that. Our brother Tom Syracuse speaks again. And whenever he speaks, if you pay attention, you get educated. Wonderful. Thank you, Tom Syracuse. Sister Betty Davis, the mic is yours. Sister Betty Davis, the mic is yours.
We want to keep this momentum going because we've got quite a few hard hitters in the audience. And I want to remind y'all that Tom is the one who made it clear Bloomberg closed over 20 hospitals in New York City. Without further ado, we want to keep it going, and I appreciate that everybody is mindful that there are a lot of speakers. Joel, your mic is open, and Sister Dolores, hang in there. Joel. Brother Joel, your mic is open.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Hello? Loud and clear.
Oh, okay. I really like that menu of action that Tom just came out with. However, we're talking about calling for all of these different programs, which we're predicting, probably correctly, that Mr. Cuomo and Ms. de Blasio are either unwilling or unable to deliver within this system. And actually, we also have to consider the people that are able to deliver a decisive blow within the system, and that's the work people who are at once the people who create all the values, the people who create all the services, perform all the services, and also people who whose money, the landlords call their money. You know, when they gentrify a neighborhood, when they charge $3,000 a month now for a shoebox, so-called studio apartment, and then they have this money, you know, when they give that money to the different politicians or withhold it from the ones that aren't licking their boots enough, and they have all of this money, which they call theirs, which is really what was given to them by the tenants, what was extorted out of the tenants. Let's say it wasn't given, it was extorted out. They say you want to live in such and such an apartment, well, the price is $3,000 a month. Maybe you don't make $3,000 a month. That's a big salary, and that's just for the rent, right? So the place I think that we also have to consider is for the people to begin to hold back what the ruling class wants from all of us. If we want to have rent forgiveness instead of the rent delay that we've just had while we kept the courts closed, but with many people now being threatened with eviction because many people haven't been working over the current months. Maybe some people spent part of the money that would have been taken away from them for rent, for other necessities like food and so on. And I notice a lot of the prices of food have been jacked up to some degree by the retail. I don't blame necessarily the bodega owners or the mom-and-pop owners of mom-and-pop shops, but it's the market which determines these prices, supply and demand, and everybody is getting pinched. So you have to remember also that that when we go to the store, we're not just paying to keep the bodega open, paying for the things that are bought wholesale that we buy retail. We're also paying the rent for the that the landlords are starting out of here. So the idea is that there should be a rent strike, commercial and residential rent, in order to have any leverage to be able to bargain with these people that we don't blame enough, because we're the ones that pay that rent everything. We don't need them at all to extort rent out of us. So it's a logical situation where they need us more than we need them, and there should be a rent strike that forces the and this should be on a citywide or even a statewide basis, depending on how well it could be organized, to put maximum pressure to have a rent, not just a delay, so that a lot of people get evicted after 3 months, but rent forgiveness during the strike. So many people have become unemployed, don't have as much money as they used to, and the landlords are greeting you all the time, and you can be sure they're going to take advantage of the coronavirus to monopolize more neighborhoods through the mechanism of gentrification, which is a combination of upgrading properties, meaning that more rent could be charged, and also using that to ethnically cleanse many neighborhoods. Those two things go hand in hand with gentrification, and it's an economic, it's really an economic war. And so far, with all of the tensions going on with the marching in the streets by the thousands or even the hundreds of thousands of millions, if you add them up, we have to ask, where is the so-called regular labor movement? Where has that been? Because the working people in this country, even though many of the jobs have been exported out of the country in order to basically export class struggle out of the country, there's still many working people who, if they come together and strike, can immediately land some punches on the money classes, and that combines the landlords, very closely connected with the banks and the real estate industry and the insurance industry, president. And in addition to that, get people into the habit of feeling our own strength, because if we don't feel our own strength, and if we don't know what we can do, and if we don't realize that the strength of our exploiters and oppressors is only, their only strength really is our complicity in giving them money and labor and going along with their more and more ridiculous ideas about how society.
Yes. Joel, I'm going to have to interrupt you at this point because you seem to be fading on our end, but I hope everyone heard what he said about why we cannot tolerate this situation. We need to know that we can strike. And he's not just talking about workers. He's talking about people who pay rent. And he pointed out for us the tax, the people who have the money are not paying the tax, at least not in New York. He made a lot of points. Unfortunately, his signal is kind of low. We're going to move right on, but Joel, we thank you. We're going to have to let you start at the beginning next week, and along with that, we want to say we're going to have a program next week, and that'll be the last one for the month of July. We'll come back in August. So the first Tuesday in July, we will be having our program. That's next week, and we're going to give everybody a little bit of a break to recharge. We'll be back in August. Again, we will have a program next week. Hope everybody will come back, and we will start with Joel because his signal seems to be fading. Without further ado, we want to go to Sister Joel.
Sister Betty, may I cut in? Sister Betty.
Yes.
Our brilliant Joe Myers has just given us another insight. Where are the unions? And maybe we will take a moment to discuss the where, the why of the union absence in any movement. But not for tonight. Joe will come back, and understand, folks, we promise you, Joe will be back, and he will educate us again. Sister Betty, the mic is yours.
Okay, we want to remind people that I would like to discuss this Black Lives Matter front. It's very important that you recognize that Black Lives Matter is getting funding, and we're not saying that to attack the people who protest and put their lives on the line. within Black Lives Matter, but the Ford Foundation and Borealis Philanthropy recently announced the formation of the Black-Led Movement Fund, BLMF, a six-year pooled donor campaign aimed at raising $100 million for the Movement for Black Lives Coalition. Watch out, folks. Can you spell co-optation? Sister Dolores and Brother Paul, thank you for hanging in there. Sister Dolores, your mic is open. Sister Dolores, your mic is open. Unmute yourself. Okay, so we're going to go on to Brother Paul. I think I saw him.
Can you hear me now?
Oh, yes, sweetheart. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, I just wanted to say something very briefly about the anti-police brutality protest marches. They pass by my block once or twice a day going to and from Union Square or through my block going downtown. And a week or so ago, I witnessed cops wrestling three protesters down to the ground and arresting them. And there were like maybe 200 protesters in all. And after a while, the protesters started their march again, and they started marching uptown on 8th Avenue. The cops followed them in cars with the bullhorn, ordering them out of the street and onto the sidewalk, threatening to arrest them all. But the protesters just ignored them and continued marching in the street. I've joined them for several blocks, but those young people sometimes march too fast for me to keep up with them. You know, but it's just a wonderful thing that they're able to maintain it. This afternoon, there was another march of protesters who sat down on the ground at the intersection of 5th Avenue and 14th Street, and they sat there for quite a while with their signs and chanting, and they blocked traffic in both directions on 14th Street and on the 5th Avenue downtown traffic. And they were there for quite a while. While I was watching, I was waiting for the buses and the cars that were blocked from moving to start blowing their horns impatiently. But no one did, you know. They just waited until the protesters started marching again. And throughout the whole time, I saw no cops, which is very interesting. I mean, they might have been there, you know, in plain clothes or something like that. But I also have been thinking lately about this Kerner Commission, which was like more than 50 years ago or so, Commission on Civil Disorders. And it followed the Detroit and Newark race rebellions, and that was under President Johnson. They addressed racial inequality, and they studied the causes of urban riots. Now, they found that this was a nation. We have a nation here of two societies, one black and one white, separate and unequal. And they called for more aid to black communities in order to prevent future racial violence and polarization. And they called for the establishment of programs that would address the seriousness of the problems and the main recommendations, okay, along those lines. It was totally ignored. Okay, and that was like more than 50 years ago. And so here we are again, right? And then I'm also thinking about the people are talking now again about reparations. That's resurfacing. But I'm remembering like maybe 20 years ago or so, there was this World Conference Against Racism and the Struggle for Reparations in Durban, South Africa. It was like about 20 years ago, and the U.S. boycotted it. And at that conference against racism, racism was declared a crime against humanity. So what's been the outcome? You know, that was in 2001. The Kerner Commission was in 1967 under President Johnson. And we're still here, you know, with the same issues. It's so frustrating.
Well, thank you, Sister Dolores. You put your finger on it, and we need to use people's knowledge of history so that we don't repeat it. And for the last 400 years, that's what we've been doing. And that's why the whole thing of this $100 million funding for Black Lives Matter is very crucial. Brother Ralph,
that's
before
very interesting
I go,
too.
Yes, Paul Gilman and Gwen, did you want to interject? Okay, Paul, your mic is open, and Gwen, we're going to open up your mic as well. Paul, your mic is open.
Hey, everybody. It's Paul Gilman from the Bronx Greens. I have two things to report. The first report is, you know, continuing a line of police brutality and genocide and inhuman treatment of people. The Bronx Greens held a vigil and teach-in on Friday, June 26, the 45th anniversary of the incident in Oglala. That's the incident where Leonard Peltier was falsely convicted of killing two FBI agents on Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. You know, you can go to whosleonardpeltier.info, whosleonardpeltier.info, to do more research on the case. That's the International Leonard Peltier Defense Committee. And, you know, we had about a few people showed up. We got to make speeches on a loudspeaker to the people in Union Square. And, you know, life goes on. You know, Leonard's been in prison since 1976. And all the stuff they did to the Indian movement back then, the COINTELPRO, they can still do now. Leonard's case is still relevant today. They're still trying to, like the Ford Foundation money you just mentioned, all kinds of ways to disrupt and derail movements. And so I think people should pay attention to the Leonard Peltier case and, you know, write letters to him and et cetera, write letters to your legislators, Congress people, asking them to ask Clinton for, Trump, to pardon him and give him clemency based on humanitarian needs, you know, COVID. That was all mentioned. Ann Lamb, shout out to Ann Lamb. She covered a lot of this stuff. What's happening to the other prisoners is also happening to Leonard Peltier. And the second thing I'd like to mention on a different topic, does anyone want to say anything about Leonard Peltier?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is Ralph Pointer. I must self-criticize because I looked forward to the 20 minutes to a half hour you offered me for Union Square. I had emergency to go out of town, but let me tell you, the next time I have opportunity to speak about the indigenous people of America, Leonard Peltier, that history, come to the event, because I'm going to lay it out, much in the fashion, I hope, of Ward Churchill, as to what happened, what is happening to the indigenous people of America. I have self-criticized. Please come out when you hear Paul Gilman say there's going to be a Leonard event, because I'm going to let it roll. Thank you.
You're motivating me to do another one.
Sister Betty, your mic is good.
And
all right.
Can I change the topic real quick? Oh,
yes,
I'm sorry, Sister Betty.
Go ahead.
All right, I'll be quick. You know, we're talking about all the contradictions within capitalism. It's not been able to resolve the COVID crisis. In fact, it's making it worse. It's making the housing situation worse. I mean, every single facet of our lives, the COVID is making it worse. And here's another twist. This is how absurd capitalism is. In New Jersey and Illinois, where they legalize pot, you know, so a lot of the people who rely on cannabis to treat their illnesses, you know, like the Wasting's disease or your AIDS, you know, help you deal with your AIDS meds or deal with the chemotherapy, you know, they started relying on these legal pot. And then the COVID crisis hit and it dried up. And, you know, there's no provisions where you could grow your own. And so even when capitalism tries to do the right thing, it still screws it up. They legalized pot. The whole thing got disrupted. And now these people are stuck without access to medicines and they have to go back to the old ways. Isn't that absurd?
Well, capitalism is absurd, but you better believe
right.
somebody's making a buck off of that. I want to
That's
go to
right.
Sister Gwen. because she has been very active dealing with contradictions and the struggles that's going on in the stream, and I want to include her. But I also want to give a shout-out to Jericho. Ann Land can correct me. I think Jericho did a – National Jericho did a big Zoom thing for Leonard Peltier, and they had a tremendous response. Am I correct, Sister Ann, if you're still on?
Yes, actually, that was IOPTC and Amnesty. They've started a weekly podcast, the whole history of, you know, what happened to Leonard. The first one was on Friday, which was one reason I couldn't be in two places at once. One, I was on the Zoom, which was tremendous. And I'm going to be putting out the links to the podcast. It's going to be a weekly podcast, and I would encourage everybody to listen to it, especially people who don't know the case, because, you know, there's a lot of complicated factors involved in that case. There's a whole new generation of people out here who may not have any idea who Leonard Peltier is, or and many of our other political prisoners as well. And so these two young men have gotten together and have been interviewing, you know, people who were on the scene day of, you know, incident in Oglala, and who were, you know, part of, you know, the whole thing. And so it's extremely interesting and extremely moving. And, you know, these are people who have known Leonard since, you know, he was young, still there for Leonard, still trying to get Leonard out. So definitely he's an innocent man. He was totally framed by Colin Delco, and the podcast is fantastic.
When is the next podcast?
It will be Friday.
What time on Friday?
I'm not sure what time they are. I don't think they said.
Okay. All right. Thank you. We really appreciate it.
I will look up the info and send it by email for sure and post it up on JerichoNY.org.
Okay,
thank you, dear. I think it's on JerichoNY.org now that I think of it. I believe I saw it there the other day.
Your mic is open, Gwen.
Okay. Hi. Hi, everybody.
Hey,
I just want to have a quick couple comments to make. First, as regarding to Black Lives Matter, I called Ralph this morning because I think I made a mention this last week that what I see in this movement is there's a lot of physical power. There's a lot of people. There's a lot of people that are in good shape. And it seems that there is some wins. But once they get to their wins, they seem to have lost direction. And I believe that this group is being co-opted in so many different ways. And, you know, what we're getting lost in are going into a rabbit hole of ideas. And instead of paying attention to the really critical things that need to be addressed right away, we're getting lost in philosophy and we're having fights over, you know, what statues should come down. And to me, that's just not the most important thing when it comes to this struggle. And the other problem is that unlike the unions that have not gotten out to support the groups, the corporations certainly have gotten in front of this thing, and they have certainly gotten an incredible amount of spin and PR out of it. And I would caution people that are in this group that are taking the millions of dollars. I mean, they've already taken $10 million. They supported Hillary Clinton when she was running against Bernie Sanders. And it sort of takes away from the clarity of the message when you allow yourself to be co-opted by all these different groups. Me personally, I actually have never incorporated as a not-for-profit in anything I have ever done, because frankly, I think if you don't come to the table as a volunteer, and I know there are monetary issues, but you know what? When things get done strictly volunteer, they really get done, and they actually get done quite quickly. But once money gets involved, then everything slows down, and the struggle becomes over the money and not so much about the clarity of the fight. I guess the other thing that I wanted to just remind people of or talk about, I think Joseph touched on this, was that, you know, the slavery has been around for 2,000 years, and racism is actually a new formula to tap slavery, which is labor, and getting it for free or cheap or nothing. And the idea that the groups out here, one of the groups is saying that they want to actually voluntarily segregate into three different groups, really makes the group itself lose steam. When people understand that class and race have to be married together or nothing will be won, and that everyone wins when we do that, because this is the formula that was used to keep people down. You gave a few crumbs of something to some white person that was poor, and that allowed them to feel like they could step on the neck of the black and do the work for the plantation owner. People are now beginning to understand, especially now, because kids do not make very good money. Millennials don't make good money. They have a tremendous amount of college debt. I think they're putting together these two topics, and that's what's bringing the unity in. But one of the things I would suggest for next week is that everyone here is an activist, and you've all been doing it for many years. And what I'd like to know is if we could put our ideas on the table, how to help Black Lives Matter continue this movement and go further with some of our ideals. One of the things that these kids don't have is they don't have our time and our experience. And there are so many people here who have done such excellent work that I had called Ralph this morning and suggested that we put a program together where we talk about our experiences in the past and what we've done that actually works. And I'm hoping that maybe next week people can will and can do that. And I'll leave it there for tonight. Thank you.
Brother Ralph, the mic is yours, and Sister Gwen, thank you so much. Brother Ralph, take us home.
Yes, my brothers and sisters, it's been a wonderful evening. I have learned so much. Look forward to seeing you next week, and I wish I knew how it could feel to be free. Sister Betty, take us home.
Thank you. Thank you. Remember, next week, same time, same radio blog station. And after that, we're going to take a little hiatus, but we will be back next week. Thank you again.
Say I'm loud, say I'm clear, Father.